It's 7 p.m. Thursday, and this is All About Wine. With All About Wine's resident wine expert, Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery in Land O'Lakes, Florida.
First, we were talking last week about Asian wineries and Asian grapes. We're going to finish up Australia today. That's what we're doing with the French. So we're continuing with France. Basically, what we're trying to do on this program is trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly. Mike and I were talking about it, the possibilities of hooking up with different wineries in different states and finding out what's going on. Sounds like it might be a whole lot of fun.
Holyfield Vineyard and Winery in Basser, Kansas.
Organic Farm on the coast of Maine near Mount Desert Island.
Westport Rivers, Westport Mass.
Haverhill.com.
The Napa Valley of the Midwest.
RainbornWines.com in Santa Rosa.
Ten Spoon in Montana.
Alba Vineyards.
We're the largest estate vineyard in New Jersey.
Heritage Vineyards and Winery, New Jersey's top-rated winery for 2011.
India Vineyards on Route 93, that's the main highway coming right up the center of New Hampshire out of Massachusetts.
Bebach Winery, we are actually the highest-rated red wines in New Mexico.
Well, Southwest Wine is actually located in Deming, New Mexico.
Well, La Viña is the oldest winery in New Mexico.
Castello di Borghese, the first winery established in Long Island.
Flathead Lake Winery, and we're located at Cushier Park in Montana.
Mammoth Prairie Winery in Moscow, Idaho.
Brotherhood is America's oldest winery since 1839.
Ithaca, New York, College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, grapesandwine.cal.cornell.edu.
The website is freethegrapes.org.
All right, grab a phone and let's talk about wine tonight. Dial area code 646-727-3235. That's 646-727-3235. All right, let's start the show and let's talk about wine.
Absolutely.
Hi,
wonderful.
Best people.
Great weather outside. It's getting cooler and everything.
It's gorgeous. You know, every time I listen to that opening, you got to marvel at the number of wineries around this country. I mean, Montana, Idaho.
Yeah.
It's always just amazing. People come into the winery and they start talking about wineries in different states, and I start telling them that every state in the nation has them and all that stuff, and people are always surprised that the all the wineries around this country.
The number of them on our intro is probably by now it's less than half of who we've talked to since then.
Oh, yes.
So there's plenty more. You could probably redo that and turn it into its own show.
Yeah. Just talking about all the people saying hi to us. Yeah, really.
That's right.
It's just amazing the number of wineries around now. That's just, and are opening all the time. We've talked to wineries that were a week from opening and stuff like that. Speaking of which, and I want to cover this real fast here. Pull this up here because I want to tell everyone about this. We talked to a winery when we were talking to Ohio, where is it here now? I might have dumped the email. But we were talking to a winery in Ohio, and I got an email from them. They closed out. They had a closeout sale, and they stopped production. All the wines that they still had, they were offering at tremendous discounts and major discounts and stuff. Just get rid of all the stock and everything. And I emailed them and I asked them, what's going on? Why are you closing out? Was there a problem or what's going on? They emailed me back and they said that they got a job offer on the West Coast of the United States, and they were in Ohio, and they said there's just no way they could take care of it and do all that. So they, instead of selling it, and they didn't have the time to sell it, they just went ahead and closed it. So,
wow.
Yeah, it was. I'm sorry, I can't find the winery. It would take me a few minutes to find it, but it was one we had talked to from Ohio, and I was getting emails from them, and then I got these closeout emails, and so I'll see if I can't find it. If I don't find it now, I'll find it and let everybody know what it is next week. But I keep forgetting to tell people about that, and I wanted to.
Yeah.
I wanted to tell everyone about that. So.
Wow. So, okay. Well, wish them the best of luck. We'll find out who it is, but best of luck to them in their new venture, and maybe we'll see them crop up again sometime.
That would be cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Well, we have a guest tonight, and I think Mike's going to run off and try to grab him. So our guest is Bob Wiersen, W-E-R-S-E-N, Bob Wiersen. Bob is from Tassel Ridge Winery. What did I do with Tassel Ridge? I lost Tassel Ridge. I had it here just a second ago, and it disappeared. Let me get it back here. Tassel Ridge Winery. It's in Iowa. I visited Tassel Ridge when I was up in Iowa. I had when was it? End of last month. I was telling you about being there and going up in big cousin reunion. And while I was there, we took a trip up to Tassel Ridge, or Tassel Ridge, T-A-S-S-E-L-R-I-D-G-E, Tassel Ridge Winery. We took a trip up and visited Tassel Ridge Winery. And great winery. I mean, it's a beautiful winery. I told them about the radio program. I asked them to be a guest, and they said they would be more than happy to. I called up there, talked to a couple of people, and then this morning, Bob called me, and Bob is the proprietor of Tassel Ridge Winery, and said that he would be more than happy to come on to the program and join us. So he is going to be with us here shortly. We are, Mike's out trying to grab him, trying to get him on the program here. So I think he said that the number we're going to be calling is going to be going through the secretary, and they're going to have to grab him and all that. But Tassel Ridge Winery, a beautiful winery up in Layton, Iowa. I'm not sure how that's pronounced. I'll have Bob explain it to us. And he while I was there, they have a big, nice tasting room. Their website, if you want to tune in on it and check out the website. Wait a minute. I'm having Mike talk to me here, and I'm going to have to try to find him where he is and see. Well, I don't know. Dead air here. So Mike's trying to get a hold of him right now. While he's getting a hold of Bob, there's something I wanted to pass on to everyone. And let me find my note here about it. And future programs. I'm trying to get a hold of barrel makers and cork people and bottle people and all sorts of different things that do things directly with winery business, things that you don't think of out there too much. But I just did a bottling over the last couple of days, just finished up a bottling over the last couple of days. And because of that, I was thinking that it would be very good to get a hold of some of these people who do corks and bottles and capsules and all these other things that you just take for granted, but we have to worry about in the business. So, I see Bob's sitting there in the green room waiting to join us. Let's get him on to the program here. And hello, Bob. Welcome.
Hello there.
Thanks for joining us.
Greetings tonight from wet and rainy Oskaloosa, Iowa.
Wet and rainy, is it really up there? Yeah.
Yeah, and cold.
And probably cold.
Yeah.
Yeah, compared to us down here in Florida, you're probably, in the 60s?
No, actually, 41 degrees right at the moment. And, yeah, it dropped approximately 30 degrees since 7:30 this morning.
Wow.
We've had a front move in, and I think winter's upon us now.
It sure sounds like, if nothing else, at least fall.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us tonight, though, Bob. You're warm, I hope.
Absolutely. Nice and cozy inside.
Number one, how did you come about the name Tassel?
Tassel Ridge. I bought a piece of property out on our state highway, Iowa State Highway 163, which is a four-lane highway that goes at a southeast northwest angle from Des Moines down to about Ottumwa, and then goes due east to Burlington, Iowa, which is right on the Mississippi River. And in Iowa, angular roads are an exception. Almost all other roads are north, south, east, west. And anyhow, this is a four-lane freeway-type highway. And so this property is 87 acres, and I'm scratching my head what to call the winery. We'd come up with a couple of names that we liked and found out that they weren't available for one reason or another. Other people were using them, but we really wanted something unique and something that we could protect. And I was coming up with one name after another, and my wife, who's been my partner in this project since the beginning, kept vetoing them one after the other. So I felt that I wanted something that was really local. I mean, my goodness, there are more Mountain View wineries and Lakeview wineries and this and that and the other thing. We wanted something distinctive. And so I started thinking about names that were had some connection to Iowa. And one day, I think maybe it was over a two-day period, at least three, maybe four people came up to me and said, "Bob, you know that land you just purchased? It is a small community, so everybody knows everybody else's business." But they said, "You know, I met my husband or my wife detasseling corn on that property many years ago." And detasseling is used when you're growing seed corn, and that was how the property was used for many years. And I said, "Whoa, wait a minute, that's kind of Iowa, and it's interesting. It resonates with people in Iowa. It doesn't resonate with almost anybody else in the world, but it does resonate with people in Iowa." And so I decided on the tassel part, and then realized that we were on a ridge. Now, maybe a ridge, and for in the flatland parts of the country, people won't be too critical of. I would imagine people from California are going to look at this and say, "Ridge? Oh my goodness! It's only about 50 feet high. What are you talking about?" But it really has shaped the geology and the soils on our property, and it is a ridge in the sense that it's probably about 100 feet higher than the surrounding land. So Tassel Ridge Winery grew out of that.
Fantastic. When I was up there in Iowa, like I said, I visited your winery at the end of September, and while I was up there, I have some relatives up there, and they taught me the Iowa corn song. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
it goes corn, 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 corn. Oh, a tree. Corn, 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 corn. Oh, a rock. Corn, corn.
It doesn't count unless it's corn and soybeans, so I will say you're right on about that.
Okay. Yeah, that's true. Why that particular location? Any significance, or you just found the land there?
Well, we wanted a location that was readily accessible from a highway, and we're on paved roads all the way. You don't have to drive on rock roads and things like that. We thought that would increase tourism traffic, and at the time, initially, we thought it would be important to be accessible by buses, so when we laid the ground out and designed the winery, we designed it for bus tours. That has not worked out well, but the bus tours here in Iowa, anyhow, are usually not too profitable for us, and so we've kind of gotten out of that kind of business. But that's kind of the location being on a major highway just meant that people could get to us more easily. And then after we had purchased the property, I started having soil surveys done and realized I had an inkling. I had a pretty good piece of ground. And the more research we did on it after we'd purchased it, the better it looked. And the soils are a loam-luss mixture. I think everybody knows what loam is, but luss is a windblown sand, And that gives the soil its really good draining characteristics, which is what you want for a really successful vineyard, regardless of where you are in the world, I think. So that loamless mixture, and it's with very little clay. There are pockets of clay in it, but it goes down 20 to 25 feet in the places we've done test boring. And so that means you have well-draining soils, which is exactly what grapes are looking for.
You approached it as a vineyard from the beginning, though. That's what you were planning on doing?
Well, we wanted a site for the winery, actually, but this is 87 acres, so there's not many wineries except maybe Gallo or something like that that really build that many buildings. So we were going to use the extra space for vineyards, and it was part of a package. We also have three other vineyards, two of which we own and one which we lease, within about a 4-mile, 5-mile radius of the winery. And we have approximately 67 acres now planted
Wow.
two vines.
That's a lot of acreage for under vine. Now, you was telling us about the soil a little bit there. Do you do a lot of irrigation, or are you getting, well, I know this last summer was horrible, but do you do a lot of irrigation, or do you get enough rainfall to take care of it?
Well, our vineyards are irrigated. Three of the four vineyards are irrigated. The one that I lease is not irrigated, but it's right close to a river, a fairly good-sized river. When I say close, it's within 1,000 feet of it. And so we think we have pretty good groundwater there. But we are drip irrigated every place else. I can tell you that until this last season, we had not turned the drip irrigation on in probably 3 years. So we had to get our irrigation contractor out to make sure that everything was working, and we got blown lines replaced and things like that to be ready for irrigation. And then we only used it about 6 or 7 times. So fortunately, we didn't have to use it very much, but mature vines, even in Iowa, really don't have to be irrigated except under exceptionally dry circumstances.
Right, like this last summer, yeah. So the you said 67 acres. What grapes do you have planted? Everything that you grow, or are everything that you make wine from? Or
no, what we're growing are we grow 11 different varieties. One of them is a French American hybrid called Foch, or Maréchal Foch is the first, is the real name, the full name. And the second variety that's a little and it's exceptional is a La Brusca Sport, which is called Steuben. And the rest of the varieties are all cold climate varieties. And they're selected because they will survive our winters, our cold winters, and ripen in our short growing seasons. So those varieties, like whites, ones that nobody's ever heard of, but like St. Pepin, La Crosse, La Crescent, Brianna, and Edelweiss are the five white varieties that we grow. And then the red varieties are Marquette, Frontenac, Sabrevois, St. Croix, and there's another one. And I mentioned Foch earlier that we grow, and I have a feeling I'm missing one, but those will give people an idea of the varieties. And these, again, they're all cold climate varieties, and they are unique to the upper Midwest. They're not grown anywhere else in the world, to our knowledge. And so we are having to learn. And they're fairly new varieties, too, in the sense they haven't been used commercially until about 10 years ago. And so what we don't know would fill volumes. It's a lot of unknowns. We're all pioneers. The same thing applies to what we do in the cellar, because almost all of the literature has been built on 1,000 years of vinifera grape growing. And yet a lot of it just does not apply to our cold climate grapes. Now, some of the differences in cold climate grapes is they tend to be naturally more acidic, so the total acidity of the juice is higher, and so is the pH, and the pH is lower typically, and that requires special efforts in the cellar as a result. And then we have to figure out when to harvest, and we're doing a lot of research in Iowa on that subject right now because there are a lot of unknowns in that area.
These are University of Minnesota or Cornell?
No, actually, everything that we grow here was either developed at the University of Minnesota proper, and those are the most recently developed varieties. We also have some other varieties that were developed by a man whose name was Elmer Swenson. And Elmer Swenson was a dairyman in western Wisconsin whose passion in life had nothing to do with cows. It was to develop a grape that he could grow and one that would taste good on his table. So he really was looking for a table grape, and he was crossing. Most of his crosses were Vitis riparia, which is the ditch grape. It does quite well in our northern climates, but doesn't by itself make very good juice. And Vitis labrusca, which was native to New England. And most of his crosses have labrusca in them, and that tends to have some foxy notes. Concord grape is labrusca, is pure labrusca. And so the foxy notes are what people may remember from drinking in grape juice as a kid.
Oh, so you know nothing from, well, because the University of Minnesota has really stepped up over the last 8-10 years on their cold weather program, and it's really been phenomenal because they've come out with some great grapes. Cornell, well, for years has been doing it, and a lot of the New York grapes are from there. But I just wondered if you
actually they're not they do not do as well in our cold climate as the Minnesota grapes do. They will ripen, but it's iffy sometimes, and they ripen very late, and we have some insect pressures that make it undesirable to leave our grapes hanging very late in the season.
Oh, wow. Well, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that. Wow. So the University of Minnesota came up with the ones that will survive.
Well,
they
actually were the successor to Elmer Swenson. And in his later years, he died about 4 or 5 years ago. And in his later years, he actually worked out of the University of Minnesota, and he turned over most of his work. One of the problems with his work is that he was not a trained scientist, so his records were lacking. And as a result, we don't fully know what the parentage of a lot of his grape varieties were. So he developed Edelweiss, probably one of his most successful varieties, Brianna that I mentioned, St. Pepin, and La Crosse, and Sabrevoix are all his development. And then the University of Minnesota continued on with Frontenac, for example, and several versions of Frontenac, and then ultimately La Crescent, and then Marquette. And Marquette was a little unusual in that it had one of the grandparents of Marquette is Pinot Noir.
Oh.
And you would think that means that it's it makes a Pinot Noir like wine. And my experience is it's nothing like Pinot Noir. And I find it to be more like, in some respects, a Merlot. Not a very luscious Merlot, but it's a more full bodied wine than most Pinot Noirs are.
Oh, wow. So now you get bud break when and you harvest when?
Okay. We will see bud break typically around about 1st of May, maybe the last week of April, in normal years. And we will actually typically start to harvest about the 20th of August. We'll see veraison about the middle of July, and then we'll start to harvest in about 15th of August, maybe the 20th in some years. It's been as late as the 22nd, 23rd.
And you have so many different varieties. Does that basically apply to everything? Or is some of them a later harvest?
No,
or
there are some that come on sooner than others. They are usually our first grape that we harvest is Brianna, followed by Edelweiss. Now, part of that has to do with the growth habit of those grapes and how they mature. Brianna is just ready to go early, so it's just an early one. But the Edelweiss, if we don't get it early, we end up with a lot of Labrusca foxy characteristic, which is not appealing. So it's okay in jelly, but, you know, that's not really what we're planning to make. So we generally will harvest that at 14 to 15 bricks along in that area, whereas with the Brianna, we'd like to get it up around 21 bricks.
Wow.
So it the Edelweiss is the usually the second grape that we will harvest, and the La Crescent is a white, but it comes a little later, as does the Saint Pepin and the La Crosse. But by the time we get we have 17 acres of Edelweiss, so that's a major push. And
wow.
Both the cellar crew who will work 3 really long days pressing that if we get a full harvest, and the harvest crew are quite happy to take a breather for a few days before they go on to the next grape variety.
Well, that you all hand pick then?
No, we're machine picking almost everything. The exception.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yes, we have a core van. New, which we bought new about 3. It's had its third season now. And that's the only. We just couldn't get the labor that we needed when we needed it. Because you know, if your grape variety is ready, you've got a window typically of about 72 hours to get it in, or you're going to have problems with excessive ripeness or potentially a rainstorm or something. So, as farmers, we're really incented to not dawdle around, but to really get in and get the harvest done. And with, in order to do it manually, we'd need 35 to 40 pickers, and we need them on the days we need them, and we want to start at daybreak. And, you know, people who work casual labor are not particularly disciplined anyhow, is our experience. And so we'll tell people we want you there at 6:30, and they drag in as late as 10 in the morning. And, I mean, we got a job to get done, and we just weren't getting it done. So I bought the harvester. I mean, it's a serious investment. It's $250,000. But with a crew of just 5, and these are the same people that work for us all season, pretty much all season long, they start with pruning on March 1st, and so they're with us. We will have 3 people driving equipment, 1 person in the harvester, and then we have tractor-drawn trailers that come alongside and take the fruit as it's harvested. And there's 2 sets of those. Each tractor is pulling a trailer with 3 bins in it. Each bin will hold 1,000 pounds of machine-harvested fruit. So there's a ton and a half on each one of those trailers. And as one trailer gets full, they stop the harvester just long enough to move that one out and move it to the winery and bring the one that's waiting in line up into place, and then they just start up again. So, I mean, the actual stop is maybe 30 seconds or something.
Then
we're able to harvest then at a rate of about 1.5 acres an hour. That translates to about 4.5 tons an hour.
So your acreage, I have a winery, and most people try to keep their acreage. Are there fruit right around 5 tons an acre? Is that about what you're getting? Are you
We're getting about three tons an acre.
Three tons an acre.
And that may be partly because of the way we're pruning. I'm not sure. I'm a little we have a couple of grapes that we allowed to get on the heavy side. And, you know, if you're heavy 1 year, it's going to complain big time, and you're going to hear about it the next year. So grapevine's a perennial crop, and you got to think about the future and not just about the here and now when you're deciding how heavy to crop them. Now, that's the other varieties, Concord, for example, is in upstate New York. It's a 9-ton per acre grape. But,
yeah, very prolific, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's actually, so is the Chardonnay grape, but very prolific, too, I mean, as far as that goes.
Is that right? Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, it's usually, you know, you really have to do some serious pruning to keep that down to 5 tons, so.
Uh-huh.
Your machine harvest, that surprised me. I thought maybe you, but with that many acres, you say you have 67 acres planted, I can understand why you would almost have to. The labor intensive. When you we've covered the vineyard. Let's go back. You process them. You put them in. You use stainless steel. You use an oak. What is it that you're using?
Well, the answer to that, my wife hates when I do this to her, but is yes. we normally ferment almost everything in stainless. We have done some of our. One of our dry red wines we fermented in oak, but for the most part we prefer to ferment in stainless, and we'll also do the malolactic, the secondary fermentation in stainless, and then we will move red wines to oak typically, and we use a little bit larger than normal barrels. The normal barrels, 224 liters in that ballpark. We actually use a barrel that's 265 liters, and it turns out they fit on our racks, and they give us about 15% more capacity all in the same footprint. And this was the so-called Gallo-style barrel, something they specified, so it's something that's available to us. We have some older barrels that are 225 liters, 228 liters. Actually, they're 228 because they're Bordeaux barrels, but our older barrels fall into that category. But everything we're buying now comes from Tonnellerie Radoux in Santa Rosa. They're French oak. They bring the oak in from France in containers as already cut as staves. And then they fabricate the barrels in Santa Rosa, and they will pretty much do it to our specification. So we specify that 265 liter barrel.
Uh huh. So you're getting French oak in a larger, although bought locally or in the States. And have you tried any other oak besides French, or you just like the French?
We have traditionally we've used a blend of French, Eastern European, and American oak, and we're kind of getting away from using American oak for the moment. I'm not saying that'll be forever, but at the moment we really like what the French oak is doing with our wines, and so I think we're likely to continue with that.
Yeah, it's it's funny because there's a lot of oak being made in the United States, but a lot of wineries we've talked to tend to prefer the French oak just because of the taste that it imparts on there. It's just something
of the baking spice characteristics. But there are people, though, that are doing Merlot, for example, that really prefer American oak because of the slightly different characteristic of Quercus alba as opposed to the European varieties of oak, and they are they grow differently, and of course our climate here is a little bit warmer in Missouri, for example, where a lot of the Quercus alba is grown. It's a little bit warmer than it is in a lot of France, and so they get more growth, and that translates to different characteristics for the oak.
Yeah, it's definitely does. You can tell the difference too when you start tasting the different oaked wines. It really does come out, and it doesn't take a trained palate to notice it either. It is rather noticeable. Before I go on to something else here, I want to jump back to grapes. These varieties that you grow now, your French American varieties, and
Actually, cold climate varieties.
Cold climate? Is that the
yes,
better
we
term?
Only okay. have one French American, and that's Foch. The rest of them are really cold climate varieties.
Cold climate, okay. The characteristics of each one, are they... when you get these cold climate, do they give you a lot? You mentioned that's a high acid, but do they give you a lot of flavors? Are they?
Oh yeah, yeah. The flavor profiles are frequently a little different than what we're accustomed to in vinifera. And I'll give you probably the best example I can think of is Edelweiss, which is our workhorse white at this point. And that particular variety comes across as having pronounced pineapple notes.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Very unusual in a wine. And when we make that wine as a fully dry, or we use that grape to make a fully dry wine, and then we make one that's medium sweet, about 4% residual sugar. And then Iowans generally prefer their wine sweet, and when I mean sweet.
Most of the country does. Don't kid yourself.
Oh,
we've
okay. Well,
my
experience is either California or Iowa, and I've been in Iowa for the last 20 years now, almost 20 years, and so that's kind of my frame of reference. And we sweeten it up to around 15% residual sugar, and it flies off the shelf. So, you know, we call it Chateau cash flow, but you do what the customer wants or you're not going to be in business very long. That's a characteristic of that. And then La Crescent has some wonderful grapefruit notes. I mean, the first time I tasted that, the very first time I tasted our La Crescent several years ago, I mean, I just looked at everybody. Everybody was standing there watching me taste it. They'd all tasted it, and I was looking at me. Is this grapefruit juice? And so I was a little. I was nonplussed. I mean, the nose was wonderful, and it's changed over time as it's gotten more mature. It's a little less distinctively grapefruit juice, but it did have that really nice citrusy character. So there are some differences, and it's same is true with our reds. They don't tend to be quite as luscious as some of the California varieties are, but they tend to have a little bit more structure, and they're a little more austere in the Rhone style of French wine.
I'm surprised that they're still giving you that being cold weather climates. Well, speaking of weather, what is your highs in the summer and your lows in the winter, and what is your average daily temperatures and stuff there?
Well, you know, there is an average daily temperature, and I'm sorry to say that I don't really know what that is. The joke was I ran a business in Northern California, and when they recruited me to move to Iowa 19, 20 years ago, the joke was that they told me that it was 70 degrees here, but they failed to tell me sometimes it's 70 plus and sometimes it's 70 minus. In point of fact, it tends to get warmer in the summer. An exceptionally hot day because of our humidity is above 95 degrees. We don't have very many days above 95, but the relative humidity can be 95%, and so it becomes very uncomfortable. And grapevines shut down. They stop photosynthetic activity at 95 degrees Fahrenheit. So if we get temperatures above that, we don't have any real development of the vine or the juice going on for the period of time during that day, the temperatures above 95 Fahrenheit. In the winter, in theory, it can get down to minus 25 Fahrenheit. Theoretically even lower than that, but we haven't had that experience in recent winters. I think the coldest winter here that I recall was December of 93, January of 94, and we were actually about minus 40, I think, for one day or something like that.
Brr.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cold enough that you don't step outside without covering every bit of skin. You know, otherwise, it's going to get frostbite. So you see people walking around with frozen faces and stuff like that. It's not a pretty sight.
I can imagine it isn't. Yes. Your wines. Let's talk about your wines. What each one of them? I'm, you know, wine tasting. Here we go. Winery. I'm trying to find. I'm on your website here, and I'm trying to find the list of wines.
Okay. Thunder Wines.
yeah, wines, red wine, e-lists, winemakers notes, wine awards, shipping, custom labels, harvest, retail.
Yeah, interest. click on that wines button though at the very top, the yellow one.
Yeah,
that'll show you the wine list. That's what how I found them. Just click on the main top button.
Oh, okay. Just click on that. I was looking. I was trying to break it down. I didn't need to break it down. Okay.
Yeah.
There we go.
They have very large selection of wines. And if I can, I don't mean to jump in here real quick, but on the front page, I noticed you have a, I don't know how to pronounce that, but it's a cranberry and Christmas tree wine bottle.
Yeah.
If you want to touch on that when you get a chance, the bottle looks interesting. I've never seen anything like that. That's very unique, definitely.
Well, that's all that's unique about it. It's a standard, one of our standard wines. We have one that's cranberry and the other is our Star Spangled White. That happens to use a green bottle, and then we use a frosted clear bottle or has a name, and I've forgotten what it is at the moment. But it's a frosted bottle, so it looks really nice with the pink cranberry wine in it.
It's
just special packaging, and you know people are looking for unique things to give as gifts, and that is a product that's pretty popular and that sells out pretty fast.
Very good, very interesting. Yeah, just something real quick.
That is, I saw that bottle earlier while I was looking at the site, and it is a cool bottle. In fact, while I was up there, I signed up for the email, and I've been getting emails weekly from them, and the bottle was announced in one of the emails, and so that was...
Right, that'll go on sale the weekend of November 1st.
Oh, so we got a month away. Your wines, let's talk about your wines now, if you don't mind. Each of them, the Chardonnay, is that from you, or where is the Chardonnay?
No, we can't grow the Chardonnay here. That was grown in Lake County, California. We don't put that on the bottle because of federal government regulations. Because it's considered an American appellation, we can't announce places. So, in point of fact, it was actually grown in Lake County, California.
So I noticed it's lightly oaked. That just, you know, there's just you don't do too much oaking with it then.
Well, with that particular, we've made Chardonnay on a couple of occasions, and the first time I think we oaked it a little bit too much, and the fruit on this particular Chardonnay was just brilliant, and my feeling was why cover it up, and of course with oak you do tend to obscure the fruity flavors, and I didn't want to do that, so we left it lightly oaked, and it's just a real nice fruity with citrus notes, and very very useful in wine pairing.
Now, I don't oak my Chardonnay at all, and so you know just for that reason, I like that fruitiness in the oak. Riesling, a dry style Riesling. You were just telling me about how people like sweet, and then you're making a dry Riesling.
Well, we did that because there was a, you know, wine is very faddish. You know, what's in today is out tomorrow. And there was a period of time here in Iowa when if young people would go out and they'd go out on the town, they'd go to a bar, they'd go to a entertainment kind of place, the wine that was being ordered was Riesling, and that was about 5-6 years ago. And the fads tend to start on the coasts, and they come here, depending on what it is, anywhere from 5 to 10 years later. And so Riesling was hot 5 or 6 years ago, and I felt we needed a Riesling. We had a wine that was designed. It was actually a blend of a grape we grow here called St. Pepin and Muscat. And the Muscat, obviously, we can't grow. It comes from California. But we thought that was and so we do the blend, and that's our Riesling-style wine. And it's been very successful in that market niche. We fermented the Riesling, it had great flavors. You know, some of the pear notes that are common with Riesling were just that's kind of a muted flavor note anyhow. But it was a really nice, fully dry Riesling, and I said, why mess with it by adding sugar? We'll just leave it as it is and sell a dry Riesling. And it has sold, but not very fast. And so I guess you've got to make a decision. Do you design a wine to be a commercial success, or do you design it to be an artistic success? And we took the latter path on this particular wine, and we call it a dry Riesling just so people wouldn't be misled.
One thing I learned a long time ago when the first started the winery was that we don't make wines we like, we make wines that sell.
Amen. You're not sustainable if they're not selling.
That's right. The Riesling Merlot, Syrah, all these come from Lake County, California?
Yeah. I take
it that was your previous home.
No, it wasn't. We were close to Lake County, but I lived in Sonoma County. We went to Lake County because the grapes were good value, very high quality. To get comparable quality in Sonoma County, but especially in Napa County, was just too expensive. Our market was not discriminating enough to make that justifiable. I'm not saying that they'll accept anything, but I the actual location of the vineyard is probably not going to help us sell the wine.
And the amount of money that it costs just to go to Sonoma or Napa, get it from Lake County, and you're getting quality anyway. So I understand your point.
It's really good quality. I mean, it wasn't just quality; it was really good quality.
Lake County.
Over the years, we bought a Cabernet. There, we bought the Merlot. We bought Chardonnay. We bought Muscat. We have purchased a Syrah. I think that's all of them. And we're totally out of the Cabernet now. And we're not buying any more of those varieties. First of all, we have enough of our own grapes. And secondly, we're really interested in producing a regional style of wine. And, there's lots of people producing Syrah and Merlot and those varieties. So why should we bother doing that kind of thing? We can differentiate ourselves. For example, we have a new wine that'll come out in January. It was bottled about 4 or 5 months ago, and we'll give it 6 months in the bottle, back in June, actually. And that wine is a really nice dry red wine. It is a blend of, if I remember correctly, it's Marquette, St. Croix, and Foch, if I'm not mistaken.
Uh-huh.
And each of those grapes brings a little something different to the blend. It worked out really well. So that's the long term. That's our future going forward.
Well, then I tell you what, I'm not even going to discuss this American Merlot, American Syrah, since those are going to be sold out, and you're not going to replenish them with those. So your Candlelight White.
That is a Chardonnay. It's just a sweet style of Chardonnay. And I want to say, I'm guessing now, but I'm going to say it's about 6% residual sugar.
Wow.
One of the things that's kind of interesting about people tend to think if they're going to have a salad, then, I can't serve a red, dry red wine with it. But most whites won't work with a salad either. I'm thinking of a typical Chardonnay or a Sauvignon Blanc, for example. And the reason for it is most salad dressings have a bit of sugar in them. And the sugar just really upsets the acid balance, sugar acid balance in the wine, and you end up with something that gives you pucker power that's really not appropriate when you're eating a salad. So this wine is when we hold wine and food pairing events at the winery, and we serve a salad. We will almost always serve it with this wine, or perhaps Prelude, which is a semi-sweet white as well.
I just lost my place. In the Dark, a big red wine. This is a blend.
It is. It's a dry red. And it has been our signature for some time. We have traditionally had a vinifera in it, and typically the now the larger grape presence is St. Croix, and then either I think the current blend is St. Croix, Syrah, and a little bit of Merlot. And I want to say it's 62% St. Croix and about 35% Syrah. We've changed that blend a few times, so I'm not absolutely sure that I got the numbers right. But
and the Merlot just gets a little bit dark. Yeah.
Well, actually the St. Croix has really nice colors, so we're not concerned about the color. But the you know, there's things happen, and you can't. I find it hard to explain because I think some wines actually have a catalytic effect in that they change the by blending. You can achieve some very interesting effects by just the addition of one wine and maybe only 5% to the blend.
And you know, and it's funny that you say that because you look at some of the blends on bottles that you pick up, and people ask me at the winery, they, you know, in classes I teach and all that, they said, does this 1 or 2 or 3% that you see added to these wines make a difference? And, you know, most people wouldn't think it would, but it does. It really, you know, adds something that you would not find if it weren't added in there. So
right.
It does. The Iowa Marquette, 100% Marquette?
Yes, sir.
And this is your big, but you're aged in French, Eastern European, and American oak?
Right. That's, you'll recall our barrel aging strategy in the past has been to use all three varieties of oak. And this particular wine is 2009. It was the wine was actually made in two new French oak large format barrels, are each 200 gallons, and so we got plenty of oak extraction with that wine. We actually fermented the wine, then did the malolactic fermentation, and there was a little error in how we were pumping over, and the person doing the pump overs didn't understand that she had to adjust the length of pump over time for the volume of wine. It was a function of how many times the wine passed through the pump. So she was sitting up there pumping over for 20 minutes at a time, 2 and 3 times a day. In the process, we totally macerated the fruit. And so we had to pull it out and do a filtration. And then we struggled to clean the barrels out, and so we got all of that junk out of there. And then we put it, after about a week, we put it back in the barrels and then let it sit for 11 months in those new French oak barrels. And we kept topping the barrels so that we minimized any oxygen exposure to the wine. And after that, we racked it. We put it back into stainless and then moved it almost immediately to small format French, Eastern European, and American oak barrels. And these were barrels that were maybe third-year barrels. So we got most of our oak extraction during the first year, the 11 months that they were in the large format barrels. Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a great wine. Wow.
It's a big wine. It's actually, we harvested those grapes at 28.2 bricks, which people, you can't do that in Iowa. Well, frankly, we let them hang too long. So we have a wine that's 16.2% alcohol, but it's well balanced. And I mean, we do have some people complain that the wine is a bit on the hot side, but for the most part, this has been one of our most popular dry red wines, and we have a hard time selling dry red wines in Iowa, but I can tell you this is an exception. This is doing rather well for us.
It sounds like it would. It sounds like a wonderful wine. I am sad that I did not have an opportunity to try that or even purchase it when I was up there.
Well, you'll have to come back and do it again. We provide tastings. In fact, one of the policies we have is we taste everything, even our fancy bottles of iced wine and everything else, our dinner dessert wines. They're all available for tasting, and there's no charge for tasting.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I noticed that when I was up there. That's a great thing. I'm just going to hop over real fast on this Marquette Rosé. Not that I don't like rosés, and I'm preaching to all the people I talk to about rosés that it is not the ugly redheaded stepsister. Rosés are nice. They're good. Don't be turning your nose up at them. And so,
they have their place, and this is a dry rosé. I'm pretty hardcore when it comes to my rosés, and I really like the Bandols from southern France, and I don't want them sweet. I don't want Kool-Aid. I want a really nice, fresh rosé, and I have my house has a balcony that overlooks one of our vineyards, and the idea of just sitting up there enjoying a nice glass of wine with a well-chilled glass of rosé just really lights my fire. I took a half a dozen bottles home, and I'm saving them for the right occasion. But we're finding that that wine works well with some kinds of foods. You know, you think about the Easter ham, or if you're someone who likes to have ham instead of turkey for Thanksgiving or Christmas or whatever, this makes a really nice pairing with ham. It's got enough body that it will work well without overwhelming the ham, for example. And then that's my idea of a perfect wine with enchiladas or spicy tacos, for example. It's a very versatile wine, and we really feel that's one of our best wines, is that the Marquette Rosé. And Marquette really shows off really nicely within that wine.
That sounds great too. Jumping down to Iowa St. Croix, I'm going to hit on that one too, simply because that is one of your cold weather grape varieties, and so tell us about that particular one.
Okay, the St. Croix is it has a lot of Labrusca in it, but the Labrusca is well controlled. It's not like Edelweiss, which we have to control by harvesting very early. This is a wine that has the Labrusca there, but it's in the background. And personally, I like it better as a blend. But by itself, this wine isn't bad as long as you aerate it before drinking it. So either that's in a decanter for a half hour to 40 minutes. And we recommend that when people put it into the decanter, they just splash it in. Don't be polite about it. Just turn that bottle straight upside down and just let it splash in so it's taking in a lot of air. Or use a Venturi or something like that. It opens up, and it is a very nice wine. But it is pretty closed coming out of the bottle. It does need aeration. So the grape itself is interesting. It's very thin-skinned. So when we harvest it mechanically, we end up macerating the grapes pretty bad. We end up with a bin. Our macro bins are 26 inches deep, about a yard square. And I would say that the bottom 6 to 12 inches is juice by the time you get it to the winery. So it's a grape that just falls apart when it's being harvested. And that was true also when we were hand harvesting. We would find that our St. Croix was largely juiced by the time we got it to the winery.
Wow. So the St. Croix and the Marquette, are they the tannin levels on those things? Are they, you pick up a lot of tannins? Are those?
No, they're virtually no. That's one of the problems with our northern climate grapes or our cold climate grapes. They virtually have no tannin at all.
Really?
And Marquette was advertised as a grape with its own tannins. And we've since had it tested, and we can't find the tannins in it. So that's one of the changes that we have to make in winemaking practice. And we're still experimenting with a variety of things, whether it's sawdust or granules, oak granules during fermentation. Occasionally we'll try that. And we've used barrel alternatives in stainless to try that, and sometimes we'll add staves to a barrel if the barrel's getting approaching neutral. We'll beef it up a little bit, but and those are elagic tannins, of course. Sometimes it would be nice to have natural tannins in the wine, but we just don't have that that option in most of the grapes that we grow. In fact, all of the grapes we grow.
Well, that surprised me. You say no tannins. I thought there would be some in it at least. I mean, with you're talking about the Marquette and the heavy red. I figured you'd be picking up some, if nothing else, from the skins. But it's not doing.
No, there's not much there. And one of the things with Marquette that's and one of the things we have to do with most of these varieties is if you don't have tannins, you don't have color stability. And so we have to. That's one of the reasons it's so important for us to introduce tannin during the winemaking process at some point, because if we don't do that, we're not going to have color stability.
Oh, wow, that's interesting. I never realized that. Your Iowa White Blossom, that's the one that's at Dry Device, right?
Yes. And that's that. I personally, normally a white wine is supposed to be served between 55 and 60 degrees Fahrenheit. This is one I like to chill down to around 40. And,
wow.
And if truth be known, I frequently will put it in an ice bucket and take it down as far as the ice bucket will take it. And that is really nice when it's crisp. That's another balcony wine looking over the vineyard, I'll tell you.
I picked up a bottle of that when I was there. So I was curious about it. I tasted it. It was nice flavors. I just absolutely loved it. And so I do have a bottle I'm going to be sharing with my wife. We're going to be trying that here. I've seen it lots of places. Well, I've heard talked about lots of places at wineries, but I've never had an opportunity to try it. So
I may, I'd like to make a recommendation.
Sure.
That is, you consider serving it with fish. And down in your area of Florida, that you have access to fish that we can only dream about up here. but what I would serve it with would be swordfish, for example.
Oh.
And I will then make a papaya salsa, which I take a papaya, and there's enough here, the way I'm describing it, for four people easily. We sometimes serve it, make it up one night, and we'll have fish two nights in a row so we can, the two of us can eat this, finish off this batch of papaya salsa. And I think we've even had it for as much as three nights. We like it a lot. But anyhow, you dice up skin and remove the seeds from a papaya. You dice it up into quarter to 3/8 inch cubes or something approximating that. Chop up. We kind of like a red onion, and we'll get maybe a quarter to half a cup of chopped red onion. We chop up some cilantro. We use some rice wine vinegar, a little bit of sugar, and sometimes you want a little bit of salt in it. You mix it all up, and it really is better if it sits for at least an hour before you use it, before you serve it. And if you can let it sit overnight, it's even better. So the flavors integrate better. And then that on the fish, the papaya salsa on the fish with the white blossom is absolutely sensational.
Oh, well, great. Thank you for the recommendation. We, we'll give that a try. And you're right. We do have great fish down here. the semi-sweet, your American Pink Catawba is Catawba. Did you grow that there, or do you get that shipped in?
No, Catawba and Concord are typically available. Our cost of growing grapes is north of $1,100 a ton. And we can buy that for the in most years for the equivalent of about $350 a ton. And so we'll typically buy it either in Michigan or in upstate New York, and we will buy it as juice. We have it juiced. And the reason for it is that you have to use a hot press technique in order to extract the juice out of slipskin varieties, and we don't have that technology. I mean, it's nothing we couldn't do. It's just that we don't really need it, and so we've chosen not to to go that route. It's easy. That's one that we'll buy outside. And the red, white, and blue that you see right adjacent there is our biggest selling wine, Also, it's a Concord Catawba blend, and we use that is Chateau cash flow for us. I mean, it's our biggest seller, so we're making that on a regular basis, and we just bring the juice in and vinify it, blend it, and away we go.
It sounds like that. Well, you know, a lot of these, I'm looking at, what this is, Oski Fiznet, Fizzen?
Yeah, we call it Oski Fizzanti.
Oh,
we just wanted a name that kind of rolled off the tongue when she practiced it for a while. And like I jokingly say, it only took me a month in front of the mirror to pronounce it. But and Oski, the winery's in Lytton, but it's right near Oskaloosa, and that's where the name came from. And Fizzanti kind of expresses a fizzy wine, and that's what this is. Now, we carbonate our wines. We are not doing certainly not a méthode champenoise or even a méthode charmant or bulk process. That's the plan long term, is to do a charmant process. But that requires an extra pressure tank, and I don't have space for another one. So they're quite expensive, and about $35,000-$40,000 investment. So
wow.
We're going to wait until we can expand the winery to accommodate the second tank, so I can do a charmant process. But in the meantime, we are carbonating, and that's the Oski Fizzanti Pink is very popular. We're doing quite well with that wine, and the Catawba just comes out. It's basically a fizzy Catawba, and it's sweet, to be sure, but for people who really want a sweet, fizzy wine, that's a perfect choice.
Well, you have a whole line of the Oski Fizzanti. You got the Oski Fizzanti Cranberry and the Pink, and the white and the red, and just that's your whole series of everything there. So it seems like, and all of them run sweeter and they're little carbonated.
Well, right now the white is our driest, and that's made entirely from Muscat. We're going to be making a change in that, and we're going to start to make it eventually with Edelweiss. The Edelweiss is really nice in this application. We've done a couple of tests on it, and we're really pleased with it. But at the present time, it's all Muscat. The Pink is the sweetest. Red is kind of in the middle. And the red is really kind of a pinkish wine anyhow, but it's just darker than the Oski Fizzanti Pink. And then the Oski Fizz Cranberry is a seasonal wine. And this is the first year that we've released it to our retailers. When we make these fizzy wines, we make about 160 cases at a time.
Uh-huh.
And this is intended to be sold out by the end of the holidays. And it's the cranberries. We buy the cranberry juice. Crushing cranberries is not a lot of fun. And that's a lot like work. So we don't, and you really have to have a basket press to do it. I don't think you could use a bladder press at all. We have both presses, but it's, like I say, it's a lot of work. So we buy the juice, and we sell the cranberry wine year-round, but the Oski Fizzanti cranberry is only available for 2 months, right around the holidays. So we'll roll that out on November 1st, and we had our first batch last year. It was sold just at the winery, and it was very popular, so we decided to make it again this year.
While we're speaking of fruit wines, the blackberry and the cranberry. The blackberry comes from blackberries from where?
Well, you know, when you buy juice or concentrates, you never know where they come from. I suspect it's the Pacific Northwest someplace, though. So it's not a place name. We don't actually even know for sure where it comes from. But it's a really rich, if people like blackberry, this is kind of like blackberry jam, but not quite as sweet. I mean, it goes down very smoothly. For me, I'd almost call it a dessert wine. Again, we have a really sweet taste preference in Iowa. And so this wine's pretty successful, and it's won a lot of golds and double gold medals in competitions.
Oh, wow. And, well, you mentioned dessert wines. Tell us about your what, five dessert wines here.
Yes, we... you know that wineries that came along after about 2007 or 8 cannot call a dessert wine a port.
Right.
It may be made exactly the same way, it may be made from the same fruit, like Tinto Count, Tinto or Torriga Nacional, and so on,
right.
Tinto Roras. It doesn't make any difference. If it's not made in Portugal, it can't be called a port. So we came up with a new name. We call it Finale, which is the time of the meal when we think these wines should be served. But in terms of making them, they are very made in almost the same way as a port. We offer four. The first one we brought out was our Finale Premier Red. And that was actually made from four Portuguese varieties that were grown in the Central Valley of California, and we bought the fruit and made the wine from them, and then did the blend. And this is the so the Premier Red falls into that category. We decided that we wanted to try the same process, but using all Iowa grapes. And so the Iowa Iowa Finale is then made from Iowa fruit. We have a blackberry Finale and a raspberry Finale made entirely from blackberry juice and raspberry juice. And those are really rich wines. Nice sipping wines. The raspberry, neither of those wines have any anthocyanins, so color becomes a problem. And the raspberry is already starting to turn slightly, but the flavors are amazing. And the nose on both those wines is just spectacular.
Wow.
And then we make a Grand Finale chocolate, or chocolate Grand Finale, excuse me, get the names turned around. That is basically one of the red finales made with the addition of a chocolate flavoring. The aroma, the aromatic qualities of that wine are very, very impressive. Anybody who likes chocolate loves to sit and smell the aroma of that wine. Sipping it is fine. Personally, I prefer to breathe it rather than to actually drink it. But a lot of people who are really chocolate fanciers think that's a great wine. And it's a dessert. It's a special gift, basically.
Sounds fascinating. You mentioned the not being able to use port. I've talked about it on the program before. We spent some time talking about the new, the name designation and restrictions and all that. And I've thrown out the challenge to all the listeners out there, if they can come up with a name to replace port. I mean, we have sparkling wine for champagne, but port and sherry we don't. But I see you've came up with one, Finale here. That might
well
be.
Well, we were, again, our focus is on education of Iowans, because Iowans don't consume much wine per capita. We rank 2008, we ranked 43rd in the country in per capita wine consumption. And there's really nothing genetically different about Iowans. It's just that they don't drink much wine. And they're not teetotalers. Here in Iowa, we love our beer. And, I'll speak for the other people. They love their beer and their spirits. I don't drink much of either of them. But we consume a lot of them here in Iowa. But when it comes to wine, we consume about 1.6 gallons per capita, and the national average is 2.5 gallons per capita per year. And that compares, your listeners might find it interesting to know that Washington, D.C. was 8.95 gallons per capita, followed by New Hampshire at 6.95 gallons per capita, and Idaho, of all places, was right up there at just slightly under the, I think, 6.7 gallons per capita.
Wow.
But even California was right down around the average, as is Missouri and Minnesota. In Illinois, it's about 3.2 gallons per capita. It's wine consumption in my part of the country is primarily a metro or an urban type activity. And once you get out in the country, the preferences change quite a bit.
Right. But,
so
you know,
I felt we just had to. I just felt we had to do a good job of educating people, and that's why we selected the name Finale, and to suggest when it might be appropriate to use port. Now, I've recently finished a book on port, on port wine, its traditions and history, and its current economics, and I was shocked to find out that the used to be, in fact, port was developed for the British market. And in the interwar period, the say from 1900 up to about 1940, ladies would drink sherry, and men would drink port, and they'd drink it usually after dinner, and it would be associated with cigars and that kind of thing. The French today, interestingly enough, or the Dutch, the French are actually the biggest market for port. The British are still important, but not the biggest market. The French are the biggest market for port, and followed by the Dutch. I mean, it's really, port's very popular, and typically it's served before the meal as an aperitif, which I find very interesting. It's certainly, it was anomalous. I wouldn't have expected that. If somebody had asked me, I wouldn't have guessed that. I've never seen it when I've been in Holland, but I guess I've just run in the wrong circles.
There you go. I am surprised that you said the French are the biggest consumers of port. I thought the British were. I'm surprised that the French are now.
I was too, and that's changed in the last 25 or 30 years, I think.
Ah, wow, that's interesting. Well, another question. The government, state government, and federal government. Do you love them? Do you hate them? Want to kill them? Want to hug them? What's your opinion of the government?
Well, it depends on the day and the time of day. There are times that we get along just fine, and there's other times they drive me to they drive me crazy. So, alcohol next to toxic waste is the most highly and maybe now financial services are the most highly regulated functions in society. And we try and do things right the first time, and most of the time we get along just fine with everybody, but we have our moments.
Does the state government battle the wineries there, or are they pretty good?
The state government regulation has been pretty easy to get along with. I mean, they've worked pretty hard to work with us. They do have a tendency to make rules without understanding our problems and issues at times, but they have been listening. And the problem with a regulator is that if they forget for a few seconds who they're working for and what their objective is, they can start to do some things that can be really damaging in a very short period of time. Damaging to what they're regulating. And so we pay real close attention to what they're doing and what their objectives are, and we try and keep a good dialogue going with them. It's challenging at times. Tiptoeing around each other a lot of the time.
Yeah, it happens in a lot of states. Are you in an AVA there?
No. We're not in an AVA. Iowa is, in effect, the geographical designation that we have to use. Now, there is one AVA that includes what I call the east coast of Iowa, most of the east coast of Iowa, and I've forgotten the name of it, but it's basically parts of four states, Iowa, Illinois, western Wisconsin, and southeastern Minnesota. And that is the first AVA, and it's a very large one geographically.
Mississippi River AVA?
Pardon me?
That's the Mississippi River AVA?
If there is a Mississippi River AVA, that's it.
Because that's one of the largest ones in the country, if not the largest.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mike, do you have any questions for Bob?
No, I was just going to ask about the shipping. I noticed on your wines submenu for shipping, you ship to 7 states currently. Is it a state regulation that they're against that, or is it licensing or what?
In some cases, there are probably 9 or 10 states where there are regulations against shipping wine direct to consumers. But, you know, Mike, the biggest thing is registration costs and regulatory costs. For example, Florida is not restricted at the present time. Your legislature is trying to come up with onerous regulations, and fortunately, from our perspective, they've been voted down. So we're free to ship to Florida, and we're also free to ship to the District of Columbia. But you get some other states like Arizona with multiple layers of regulation and reporting requirements down to the city level. It gets very costly, and sometimes you have to have multiple licenses in states. Hawaii is one of those, for example. It just isn't worth the hassle. And so we are licensed in Iowa, of course, in California, in Colorado, in Missouri. And I've forgotten how it works in Minnesota, but we can ship to Minnesota. I'm thinking we don't need a license in Minnesota, but there's something else we have to do, and I don't remember now what that is. And then, of course, to Florida and D.C.
Hmm. Okay.
Well, for example, in New Jersey, the only way you can get a permit to ship to directly to consumers in New Jersey is to agree to tax nexus in New Jersey. And, I mean, I cannot imagine anyone would agree to do that. That's shocking. It means filing a tax return in New Jersey. And, boy, you'd have to do an awful lot of business to justify the cost of that. And, frankly, some of the legislatures, Massachusetts and New Jersey are two of them, are really disingenuous when they come up with these rules. They know darn well that their objective is to exclude foreign, unquote, wineries. And so they come up, they make it look for public consumption like they're being open-handed and with one hand, and they've got a knife in the other one, and they've just stuck that into your back. So, I mean, it's, and unfortunately, it's just a craven appeal to parts of the electorate who aren't very discriminating. So a very frustrating situation. I would be quite happy to have a much simpler system that, I will tell you that we had some influence on the new Iowa laws that were put into effect about 2 to 3 years ago, and 2.5 years ago, I think. And here, if a winery wants to ship into Iowa, all they have to do is go on the ABD's website, the Alcoholic Beverage Division, Iowa Alcoholic Beverage Division's website. They can register online. The fee for the license is $25. Then you have to get a $5,000 bond, which is a pain in the neck, but it's a nominal cost, like $150 a year, something like that. It's what we pay for ours. And then you are required to report all shipments to consumers in the state of Iowa, collect sales and excise taxes, and report, and of course pay those taxes to the state. I mean, frankly, the taxing authority I can live with. I understand the rules and the need for that. I'm perfectly okay with it. What I've got a problem with is the states that have just all sorts of extra rules. For example, in Illinois, you've got to register every label that you're going to sell in Illinois. At $50 a label. And then they basically, if you're producing under 10,000 gallons, you don't have to register. But if you're producing over 10,000 gallons of wine, then you do. And I don't think in our case, we're big enough that we can't even ship direct to consumer in Illinois. We have to use a distributor. So
are you familiar with the site freethegrapes.org?
Yes.
Yeah, a great site that is always battling and trying to help us fight these idiotic laws.
Right. And they're well intended, but frankly, the forces that are arrayed against Free the Grapes are the distributors, the wholesalers, the wine wholesalers, wine and beer wholesalers, and it's just an attempt to control the market. And what it results in Iowa and in many other states is that you have a significantly smaller range of choice as a consumer, and the wholesaler doesn't care. They just want to make sure all the wine moves through them, and then they want to set the rules for the rest of us to live by. So as a result, I buy hardly any of my wine in Iowa. I mean, I bring what I know what I like, and I bring it in legally, and I can't purchase it from retailers because a retailer can't an out-of-state retailer can't sell wine in the state of Iowa to consumers, but I will purchase it from wineries who are licensed to sell directly to consumer in Iowa.
You know, and it's ridiculous, but it's changing, and we can only hope that it gets better.
Exactly. And frankly, the bottom line is going to be consumers who are inconvenienced enough that finally they start swinging some votes one way or the other, and I think it will change. Generally speaking, the Iowa Alcoholic Beverage Division has been really well-behaved, but frankly, their policies are resulting in Iowans having limited choices, and the choices tend to be, what's a nice way to put it, plonk. not very distinguished wines, let's put it that way.
Yeah. I'm constantly preaching to people, you know, contact your congressman, contact your representatives, let them know that we want this. Let them know, get a hold of freethegrapes.org. All these different
and
things.
Keep in mind that this is a state by state issue, so it's state elected officials, not congressional people, that have the real influence here.
And they need to get a hold of them and keep them that you want your wine out there. So
exactly.
Okay, before we go here, give me all contact information. Give me your email address, Facebook.
Before we tune off, there's one other wine I'd really like to mention that I think something we do that's fairly unique, and that's our iced wine.
Oh, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah,
it's called Prairie Snow, and it's not an ice wine. It's iced with a D, I-C-E-D wine. And that's a legal termination that's allowed by the federal government to signify that the grapes were harvested at their peak and then frozen mechanically, and then we remove them from the freezer, and we actually press the juice, a small amount of juice, usually about a quarter to a third of what we would expect normally to get. And we are tasting that juice every step of the way. And when we're satisfied that we've got most of the flavor out of the grapes, we stop the press cycle, remove the still partially frozen grapes, and it looks like a big hockey puck. And we take that and we mulch that, and we'll eventually field apply it. And then we put some more grapes in, and we do another pressing. And that juice at that point is between 44 and 48 bricks, which is like 44 to 48 percent sugar. A very sweet wine, very, very aromatic and flavorful. I mean, it's juice at that point. Very aromatic and flavorful. And we just pressed ours on October 16th, and we're now turning that into wine. And we consume the sugar. We're watching the sugar levels drop as the fermentation goes on. And as you probably know, there are not many yeasts that will ferment wine above about 16-17% alcohol.
Yeah.
We ferment this down to the point where there's still 10-12% sugar left, and then we stop the fermentation by chilling it. And we'll remove the yeast, and we have a wine that is about 12 to 12.5% alcohol, that is 10 to 12% sugar, and is a really nice wine for just sipping or for serving with some desserts. I mean, I had a delegation of people from China, wine industry people from China, at the winery earlier this week, and we served an apple tart with the iced wine, and they wanted seconds, so I quickly went up and got some additional bottles. Now, an iced wine, if you buy it from an Ontario, Canada producer, $375 is going to be priced anywhere from $60 to $90. We sell this wine for $29, and I think it's a really nice product, and one that we promote pretty enthusiastically.
It sounds fantastic, and I was going to ask you about that. I apologize. I was going to ask you.
Yeah. Oh, the great varieties that we use are La Crescent, St. Pepin, and Brianna primarily. There's a little bit of Edelweiss in it, but we've decided we don't like what the Edelweiss does to that, so we'll go after the other grape varieties that we have.
Oh, sounds great. And you can ship to Florida, too. I'm going to keep that in mind. tell us the information all about how to get a hold of you, where you are, phone numbers, emails, locations, hours, everything. So
okay.
If any listeners out there want to...
Let's start with the locations. We are located between Pella and Oskaloosa on Iowa State Highway 163. We are open Monday through Friday from 9 in the morning until 6 in the evening. We're open on Saturday from 10 until 6, and we're open on Sunday from noon until 6. So that's 7 days a week. The only days we're closed are Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day and New Year's Day, and we're open. We may abbreviate the hours on the eves before Christmas and New Year's, but we're open, as I say, 7 days a week. We have the web address is very simple. It's Tassel, like corn tassel, T as in Thomas, A-S-S-E-L, ridge.com. So it's tasselridge.com. And our telephone number at the winery is area code 641-672-9463. Or if it's easier to remember, that's 641-672-WINE.
Very good. And email info at Tassel Ridge if you need to get a hold of them.
Right.
Y'all, they will ship to certain places, but
yes, sir.
Not
we
everywhere.
Have, the six or seven states, Iowa, of course, and then California, Colorado, Missouri, Minnesota, Florida, and Washington, D.C.
Fantastic. Bob, thank you so much for taking time out this evening to join us on the program. Very informative, very interesting. It was a great program, and I do appreciate you joining us.
It's been my pleasure, and if I can ever help again, I hope you'll call back.
Wow, thank you very much for the invitation, and good luck to the holiday seasons, and next time I'm up visiting family, I will definitely include you in the trip up there. So
Just let me know when you're coming, and I'll plan to be at the winery to meet you.
All right. Sounds real good. Thank you very much for joining us tonight, then.
Thank you, Ron.
Good night. All right. And that was Bob from Tassel Ridge Winery. What a, you know, a great place up there, too. I have to tell you, fantastic place. Mike is no longer with us because Mike got lost. I don't know if I'm even with us, too, because our recording time might be over. So if we are still in the program, thanks for joining us. Do appreciate it. We will be back next week. Mike won't be with us next week, but he may be giving us a call from a winery in Colorado. So if that's the case, we'll look forward to that. Check the emails. Check the Facebook page. And keep up with the site, and we'll keep informed. And we look forward to seeing everyone next week. Tune in next week. Have yourself a safe and and wonderful Halloween. And we'll talk to everyone next week. Night.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio. A special thanks to our special guests who have appeared on the show, and thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in and supporting All About Wine. Be sure to follow us on Twitter and like our Facebook page. Go to twitter.com or facebook.com/AllAboutWineBTR. We welcome your comments and questions by email at allaboutwine101@gmail.com. The email address again is allaboutwine101@gmail.com. All About Wine is a weekly program featuring Ron, Vice President and General Manager of Florida Estates Winery. The winery is located at 25241 State Road 52 in Land O'Lakes, Florida. From Interstate 75, take exit 285 and go west for approximately 4 miles. Or from US 19, the Suncoast Parkway, and US 41, go east on State Road 52. The winery is open daily, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. for retail sales and wine tasting. Visit the gift shop and enjoy the peaceful setting outside under a large shady canopy of oak trees. Florida Estates Winery is pet friendly and picnics are welcome. For more information, call area code 813-996-2113. That's area code 813-996-2113. Or visit us on the web at www.floridaestateswines.com. Again, that's floridaestateswines.com. Be sure to subscribe to our informative bi-weekly newsletter. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine on Blog Talk Radio.